Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Half a year since the beginning of the Israeli offensive on Gaza, the world is still stuck between outrage and paralysis, sickened by the unapologetic mass killings and being unable to put an end to them. What can possibly pull Gaza out of this decades-long, dead-end geopolitical procrastination? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Saul Takahashi, professor of human rights and peace studies at Osaka Jogokuin University in Japan. Professor Takahashi, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Now, in my introduction, I used this word procrastination, which in the case of Gaza has been the prevailing attitude in denying the Palestinians the long-promised state. But over the last 6 months, it's also been a way of stripping them of the most basic human rights of all, the right to live. And I want to start by asking, what do you think makes it possible for Israel to carry out its policies and for the rest of us to be sickened and outraged, but to little or no avail?
Well, I mean, the problem, of course, is the decades and decades of impunity that the state of Israel has enjoyed. I mean, from the beginning, the early Zionists, they sold Britain and then later on the United States on the idea of creating a Jewish state, in the land of Palestine, saying that they were going to act as an outpost of Western imperialism. And so the British and then later on, now we see the United States, of course, you know, they bought it. They basically agreed to act as the protector and to facilitate and allow and to be complicit in anything and everything Israel did. So that's basically what we're seeing. I mean, that it's, you know, this is where we are. I mean, it's been going on really for over 100 years, in actual fact.
Absolutely. But in one of your articles, you also suggest that this carnage in Gaza may mark the end of this Western-led world order, Western imperialism, based on the rules that are compulsory for the most, but non-binding for the yes. West itself. Now, this is not the first time we've encountered the deadly consequences of Western policy, of Western patronage, as in the case with Israel. What makes the current situation in Gaza so much different from what we saw before in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, and many other places?
Well, I mean, like you say, Western hypocrisy is hardly new. And these kind of double standards have been really, really blatant. I mean, certainly, you know, ever since the Ukraine as well. I mean, it's been so, so blatant and so in your face that it really has been getting, it's been getting intolerable, I think, to the people of the world. But I think what's happened now is with just, you know, the scales have tipped, basically. I mean, it's a cumulative effect. But what's happening now in Gaza is so outrageous and so clearly a genocide. It's a textbook case of genocide, as one of my former colleagues and many scholars have called it. And yet we see, you know, full throttle support by the United States and by many of the European countries for Israel. It's only, you know, it's only very, very recently since and after huge amounts of public outrage, and after the killing of a few European aid workers, it's only now that finally we're getting to see just a little bit, tiny bit of maybe there's a little bit of pushback from the United States and many of the Europeans. But most people in the world have basically had enough. And that's what we've been seeing. We've been seeing this huge outpouring of support for the Palestinian people, of solidarity. And of course, in response, a clampdown or an attempted clampdown on the part of a lot of the European countries to try to prohibit showing of solidarity for Palestine, to, you know, outlaw, ban these protests. I mean, it's been really outrageous. But it's just, the thing is, it's impossible to hide these kind of things. You know, anybody with a phone now can see what's going on. They can, you know, they're been faced with these video clips of, you know, of this genocide of
but, you know,
children
know,
being
Professor
massacred.
Takahashi, knowing about abuses and being able to do something about those abuses are two very different things. I heard you say that the Western attitude has truly been rules for thee, not for me. And I think you're truly speaking here about the entrenched Western elites who've been feeding their population's fables about how glorious their democratic systems are without actually giving their people any ability to influence foreign policy decisions. And yet we are in a major electoral year, both in the United States and in the European Union. Do you think this time around, ordinary Europeans will be able to affect the situation in any way through their votes?
Well, I think they already are. I mean, the Europeans and, you know, in particular, the Americans, you know, we look and see what's the basically the main reason that Biden is slowly and slightly been changing his tune is because he's seen that, you know, his full throttle support of Israeli genocide is losing him votes. It means that he could potentially, I mean, I would argue it's pretty clear that he's going to lose the presidency. And that's the reason that he's been changing his tune just a little bit. And same thing we see in Europe. Like you very rightly say, it's the political elite. It's the elite in these countries that is, has been supporting Israel and is, you know, full sort of lock, stock and barrel with what's been going on. But really the people are sick of it. The people have had it, and they've been sending this message to the political elite that they've had enough. And I think it really is going to change.
But Professor Takahashi, again, to play the devil's advocate here, we've seen over the last couple of years in the United States and to some extent in Europe that people may elect a candidate that the elites despise, but the ability of that candidate to actually change the policy is very, very limited. And those elites support Israel not just rhetorically, there are huge vested interests involved. I mean, we are talking about many, many billions of dollars and huge power, you know, that people do not depart with slightly. To be cynical about it, regardless of this outrage and regardless of the sort of subtle rhetorical changes the American policy, why would the powers that be in the West change anything about their behavior when they still have the largest world military under their control, as well as the levers of international financial system? What's the impetus here? What's the motivation here for them to do anything about it?
Yeah, look, there's no question that the political system of, you know, pretty much all of these countries, and I'm including my own, Japan, the political system, you know, does not allow for the voice of the people really to be reflected. I mean, we've seen this time and time again. But, I am is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? I tend to look at it as half full, and I'm a human rights guy, and I think, you know, justice will win in the end. I do believe that. But, you know, it's to say that things can never change is not really true either. I mean, things can change. Things do change, and they can change very, very suddenly, in particular in a place like the United States. So, you know, whether it's going to take 20 years, whether it's going to take 10 years, whether it could even happen next year, you know, I don't know. But for sure, the writing is on the wall. I mean, things are changing for sure.
Now, it's not just this latest assault on Gaza, but I think the entire historical situation around the enclave that serves as the epitome of the current international system, which for decades, let's face it, institutionalized not just impunity, but supremacy of might override. And I think, to be fair, it's not just the Western elites who have maintained and benefited from it. It's also the rest of the world that pretty much went along with it for whatever reasons. I asked you before about the Western voters, but I also want to ask you about people in other non-Western countries. Do you think they may stop sitting on the wall and, demand or affect some change? If not for the people of Gaza, then at least for their own sake.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think many of them already have. I mean, we've seen, you know, great outpourings of solidarity with Palestine in a whole slew of countries, and not just predominantly Muslim countries either. So, you know, people have been, it's just that in most of the countries which we live in, You know, it's very, very difficult for the voice of the people to be reflected in actual policy. And certainly it doesn't happen immediately either. But definitely, you know, the thing is, you know, we look at even, you know, even the worst sort of dictatorships, you know, around the world. And the fact of the matter is, you know, even the most dictatorial leader cannot call the shots without, you know, completely, they can't completely override the will of the people. You know, they do know that, you know, the people have to have a say. And when you have everybody with pitchforks outside, you know, trying to overthrow the government, or at least, you know, sort of expressing their displeasure with what's going on, you know, they do actually have to, you know, they do actually have to change. They have to change their tune. And we've seen that over and over again.
Professor Takahashi, you mentioned the most outrageous dictators, and I think that's the tricky part of this whole situation, because it's easy to sort of put all the blame on the so-called authoritarian governments, as many Western leaders have been, to sort of project the negative behavior that they themselves practice onto somebody else. But in this particular case, we have you know, supposedly one of the strongest democracies in the Middle East, supported by one of the strongest democracies in the West, and yet it produces a very autocratic, if not totalitarian, outcome. Do you think it may actually perhaps change the way we think about those matters? Because, I mean, I have, you know, my own agenda here, but I'm personally sickened of, you know, this cliched use of democracy versus autocracy, because I think those terms have lost their original meaning. They do not actually reflect the political realities. Rather, they're being used as simply labels for geopolitical manipulation.
I completely agree with you. And I think the whole way that we look at governance, and the whole way, I mean, obviously I'm an international lawyer, so in particular, I'm looking at international governments, but the whole way we look at governance and how the will of the people is reflected in the way things are run, you know, this really has to change. And, you know, I'm very confident it will change. In what way? You know, we have to see, and we have to, you know, we have to be vigilant and have to make sure that it's changed in a way which really, you know, which really forwards true democracy, and not, you know, democracy that is for sale, which is really what we see in most of the so-called democracies.
And I would add that the will of the people in a true democracy needs to be not only reflected, but actually followed, because I think, especially in the Western system, people's concerns are being heard in the pre-electoral campaign. They're being exploited sometimes, but taking them and transforming them or putting them into actual policies, that's a whole new endeavor altogether. And I'm not sure it's actually even feasible within the current, you know, Western governing systems. But let's talk about it some other time. For the time being, we have to take a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Saul Takahashi, Professor of Human Rights and Peace Studies at Osaka Jogokuin University in Japan. Now, Professor Takahashi, you've been writing a lot about the current international system, which, despite all its rhetorical pledges to equality and international law, grew out of the explicitly unequal and predatory colonial system. And I think we both agree that the creation of Israel as a Zionist state with the 70 plus year explicit denial of the promised state to the Palestinians is, you know, is the very typical outcome of that system. It's not an exception. It's actually the intended outcome. And I know it's a question for a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How do you think this institutionalized injustice could not be, if not resolved, then at least reformed, practically reformed?
In many ways, Palestine is really the mirror. I mean, it is really the embodiment of all the injustices of the international system. I mean, here you have a situation where you had, you know, you had people living in a land in their country. And, you know, the so-called international community at the time. And keep in mind, of course, this is 1948 when, you know, the United Nations was still very new and still very dominated by the Western countries because most of their colonies had not yet become independent. They hadn't yet won their independence. But, you know, so you have the situation and the so-called international community of the time, they walk over and basically order the Palestinian people to give over half of their country to these European colonists.
And it's absolutely, but there was still a promise that they will get their own state. And I think at the time when this was being done, most nations actually, well, at least including the Soviet Union, most nations believed that the international community is going to follow on the promise rather than, you know, procrastinating for several decades, well, almost a century now.
Yeah, well, presumably that's what they thought. But, you know, look, from the get-go, I mean, certainly I would argue that the whole mantra of the two-state solution is based on the partition resolution in 1947. And basically, this is the fundamental injustice. The so-called international community trots over and says, well, we got a great idea. Why don't you give over half of your country to these European colonizers just because we said so? You know, the whole sort of two-state solution mantra that you hear over and over and over, repeated ad nauseum by international, you know, our so-called leaders, you know, all of this is based on a fundamental injustice. And that's above and beyond the fact that the Israeli government has basically refused to, you know, contemplate any kind of sort of solution of this kind of two-state solution. And in any case, you know, de facto, it's impossible anyway. The whole of the West Bank is colonized with Israeli colonies dotted over all over the land. So it's impossible anyway. I mean, I don't see it happening above and beyond the fact that it's a completely unjust solution anyway.
And Israel is no longer suggesting that it's going after the two-state solution. What do you think Israel's primary motive at this time? I mean, I understand that you cannot get a sort of to see through Netanyahu's mind, but looking at their policies from the outside, what do you think they're trying to achieve?
Well, what Israel has been trying to achieve, what the Zionists have been trying to achieve since 1947, has always been clear. I mean, there's never been any doubt about this. It's been, you know, we want all the land. We want to drive out all the Palestinians. Failing that, we're going to kill them all. Until we manage to do that, we're going to maintain an apartheid system which maintains the dominance of the Jewish people over the Palestinians. That's always been the case. And, you know, some scholars have called this a slow-moving genocide. You know, the objective has always been genocide. The objective has always been to drive the Palestinians out. You see all this kind of talk about, you know, this is the most right-wing Israeli government in history, and, you know, Netanyahu and all this sort of political shenanigans and surrounding himself with fascists. And yeah, all of this is true. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that Israeli leaders have been doing this since 1948. Nothing has changed. And if the, you know, were the international, the system of international criminal justice, you know, were this working in any way, shape, or form, then, Israeli political leaders, not just Netanyahu and not, you know, these fascists now, but Israeli political leaders, you know, since, at the very least, since 1967, would all be in the dock because they have all furthered war crimes and crimes against humanity. None of this is, you know, a secret. All of this is out in the open.
Absolutely. And I'm sure we would both agree that this level of impunity and empowerment on the part of Israel would have been impossible without the U.S. military aid and its diplomatic shielding. But at the same time, you mentioned it earlier, Washington at this point of time loses more than it gains from Israel, because back in the 40s and the 80s, Israel could afford to do that because the United States needed it as an outpost in the region. Nowadays, the geopolitics has shifted, and I wonder if you see any potentiality of Washington either leaving Israel to its own devices or perhaps turning against it.
Well, certainly I see that possibility. I mean, I think that's a very real possibility. And, you know, it's hard to imagine now when you, like you say, when you look and see what's happening in Washington. But the fact of the matter is, you know, Israel, and I'm not the first person to say this, you know, Israel is not a strategic asset to the United States. I'm not even sure it ever was, you know, but right now Israel is a strategic liability. And that's, you know, that's very, very clear. You know, people say, oh, yeah, you know, Israel is our only Americans, pro-Israeli Americans say, oh, Israel is our only ally in the Middle East. Well, the United States didn't have any enemies in the Middle East until Israel. The Israelis and the Zionist organizations, the pro-Israeli organizations that it supports and it has, you know, it has this network with in the United States and in a lot of the European countries. The thing is, they see the writing on the wall. That's why they are reacting in such a violent way. I'm not even talking about the violence and massacres in Gaza. I'm talking about, you know, within these Western countries. You know, if you look at this this furthering of the of this notion that, you know, any kind of criticism of the state of Israel is anti-Semitic and therefore must be stamped out, must be prohibited and outlawed, that any kind of, you know, joining of the boycott of Israel is anti-Semitic and should be, you know, against the law. You know, they've been going crazy with this, you know, over the past years, and they do this because they see the writing on the wall. You know, when I was younger, I lived in the United States. This is, of course, obvious from my accent. And, you know, when I was growing up, the notion that in American universities there would be anti, you know, Israeli apartheid week, and there would be these demonstrations against the United States, the American ally of Israel, it was just inconceivable. And now they have this, you know, they have these demonstrations, they have these events, you know, all throughout the United States. And that's why the Israelis have been reacting so violently. That's why the Zionist organizations have been, you know, threatening to cut the funding to these universities and all these kind of things. So they see, you know, that's why they've been reacting in this way, because they see that they're losing the battle.
Now, I don't want to derail our discussion too much, so I'm going to pose only one question about it. But you mentioned Ukraine before, and when we look at how the Ukrainian problem sort of was created, I think there are lots of similarities with Israel, the patronage system and Ukraine sort of reaching out for military aid, you know, the far right or fascist attitudes, the idea that the United States would have an outpost that it can fully control in a strategic part of the world, as well as this outcome of this strategic outpost now trying to sort of wag the dog, if you understand what I mean. Do you see any similarities here? Do you think in strategy terms, it's a similar scenario of reaching out for, you know, for the patronage of the greatest power, of the greatest policeman in the world, and then trying to manipulate it to its own aims?
Well, I think pretty much all governments try to manipulate the stronger governments, and of course the Americans are the ones that are most open to manipulation. But certainly there's a lot of imperial overreach on the part of the United States, and certainly that's part and parcel of all these problems. And, you know, that includes the Ukraine, of course, that includes what's going on in Palestine and all throughout, you know, all throughout the world, basically. You know, we have this country which has military bases, military presences in last I checked, it's something like 160 countries, something really outrageous.
Yeah, but at the same time, not providing its own women with maternity leave, state-paid maternity leave. It's
Or healthcare. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, most Americans, you know, the vast majority of Americans, the people who are not, you know, independently wealthy, who are not billionaires, the fact of the matter is Americans live in fear. They live in fear of losing their job because workers have no rights whatsoever. You can be fired at the, you know, the whim of your boss. They live in fear of losing their healthcare. When the two are connected, of course, because if you lose your job, you lose your healthcare. And this is a disaster. And they're afraid of being, you know, going shopping and being shot at by some crazed lunatic with a gun. So, you know, this is the situation in the United States. And the thing is, many Americans see this now. They see, you know, they see that their tax dollars are going to the military-industrial complex. They're going to, you know, their proxy states like Israel, at the expense of the American people.
They can not only see it, but actually feel it in their own lives. And yes. I'm so glad that you brought up this issue of necessities of ordinary life and respecting those necessities, because as I was preparing for this interview, I discovered to my big surprise that being a human rights lawyer is actually a very practical profession, that it's not just about, you know, condemning some authoritarian regimes. It's actually about thinking through and advocating, negotiating dignified lives for the people who cannot do that on their own behalf. If you were representing the Palestinians before, I don't know what, some high authority, what kind of questions would you raise? What kind of, you know, ordinary life issues that needs to be addressed for the Palestinians to get their due, to have their basic human rights be respected, and also for peace to have a lasting chance? Because I think these two are also very intimately related.
Sure. No, they're basically two sides of the same coin. You know, despite the fact that all these, you know, all the international policymakers try to disconnect the fact of Israeli apartheid and the fact of Israeli oppression and the, you know, constant violations of Palestinian rights with the prospect of the political solution, just shows how bankrupt the whole system is, unfortunately. I mean, look, you know, I'm a human rights lawyer, and pretty much every single internationally recognized human right is of the Palestinian people, violated, you know, systematic basis every single day in Palestine. That's what it is. That's the situation. But first and foremost, you know, we have to look, I think, at the right of self-determination. This is the right that's enumerated in the first article of the two international covenants on human rights. It is the what's called sort of the platform right. It is the right of all rights. It's the right to have rights, to sort of, you know, paraphrase Arendt. It's without self-determination, without the ability of a people to decide on their own political system and their own political future and to manage their own resources, then, you know, any other kind of discussion of human rights is going to be futile, because there's just no way a foreign occupier, a foreign colonizer is going to respect any human rights. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, really the main point here, I think, is the right of self-determination. And you know, from, you know, like I mentioned, from 1947, at least, you know, most of the so-called international community, or at least the ones in power, have acted like there's an exception to self-determination, a Palestinian exception to self-determination. If there's any kind going to be any kind of lasting peace, you know, this really, you know, human rights protection, in particular the protection of self-determination, this really has to be at the core, because otherwise, you know, we're just going to see the same thing over and over.
Professor Takahashi, we have to leave it there. It's been amazing talking to you. Thank you very much for this conversation.
And thank you very much.
Thank you very much for standing up for those who cannot stand up for themselves.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.